So this is kind of a real change for this little sangha. And sangha is a community, right? A Buddhist community. To move into this community space, and it feels really nice, and it feels really appropriate to do that. So, welcome. What stimulated, part of what stimulated this change was the last meeting we had with Zachoji Rinpoche. And we've been feeling like there was a need for something to change, but I wasn't entirely sure what the need was or where things should go. But we came out of that meeting, we came out of that teaching with a pretty strong sense of how things might need to change. And how things might need to grow. And then one of the things that was really interesting about that was we talked about it, and we talked with a number of people in the group about that, what we should do, and decided that we would sort of split things up, and we would do this twice a month event here, and we'd start out by teaching, I would start out by teaching about the Heart Sutra. And interestingly, what I've discovered is that the Bodhi Center, where all of this happened in Yakima, had a board meeting after Rinpoche's retreat, and they decided to do the same thing, and completely independent of any conversation about what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that sounds good. Sounds like we're all on the right track. Sounds like a good thing. Or at least we're all on the wrong track together, whatever the case may be, but we're doing the same thing, and isn't that interesting? And then I happened to look at the website for Maitrepa Institute, which is a Tibetan Buddhist group in Portland that is sort of related to the lineage that we're connected with. And I discovered that their weekly public meditation is a silent meditation, even though they do all these other kinds of things. So I thought, well, now this is really quite interesting. Okay, so funny how these things sometimes work. So last week, I started out talking about the Heart Sutra and some of the reasons for the talking about the Heart Sutra and why the Heart Sutra was important. And a little later, we'll do some chanting of the Heart Sutra, which is very short, just as a way to introduce the meditation. But what I started to do was to work my way through the first part of the teaching of the Heart Sutra. And explained last time why it was important, and I'm going to go over that a little bit again to catch people up. So it is a teaching that is attributed to the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha himself, and it is very short. I managed to get it on one page. It's one of the shortest of the teachings of the Buddha. But actually, we know from the history of it that it's drawn from a 25,000-line sutra that the Chinese thought was very important, and they extracted a piece of it that they thought was the pith of that 25,000-line sutra, and that became the Heart Sutra. It's the heart of the teachings on wisdom. And that made its way back to India, where the Indians translated it from the Chinese back into Sanskrit, and so it has some unusual features, which in time we'll talk about. They translated it from the Chinese back into Sanskrit, and when they looked at it, they said, well, there's some stuff missing, because they didn't recognize, apparently, that it had been an extract from the 25,000-line piece, and they said, there's no beginning and there's no end, because sutras always begin, thus I have heard at one time, which is to say I was in the presence of the Buddha at one time, and he was teaching such and such a thing in such a place. And in this case, it was on Vulture Peak, or Masked Vulture's Peak, which doesn't have anything to do with the fact that there were vultures there. It has to do with the shape of it. Well, maybe there were vultures there at one time. In India, there are probably vultures everywhere, come to think of it. But anyhow, the reason for it was the shape. Kay and I have been there. It's a very extraordinary place. And then they noticed there was no ending, so they had to put an ending on it. But what they chose for the beginning and the ending is really very interesting and informative about the the way in which Indian Buddhists think about the teachings of the Buddha and think about the wisdom tradition. And then that was translated into Tibetan, and so the English translations that we have that we'll work with, one comes from the Tibetan, from the Sanskrit, from the Chinese, with the additions from the original Sanskrit, and the other one is just from the Sanskrit to the Chinese to the English. Well, I guess they all go to the English, don't they? But we'll work with both of them because it's interesting to do that. So the way the version sounds that the Indians retranslated and that the Tibetans took and that we now have in English is, Thus have I once heard, the Blessed One, which is the Buddha, was staying at Rajgir, which is a region, at Vulture Peak, along with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. And at that time, the Blessed One entered the meditative absorption on the varieties of phenomena called the appearance of the profound. Now, what I want to talk about tonight is the last part of this line, because I talked about the Blessed One. That was mostly what I talked about last time and what that's about. Bhagavan is a Sanskrit. The meditative absorption on the varieties of phenomena called the appearance of the profound. And the book that I've recommended as a commentary on the Heart Sutra, if you want to do some study outside, is this one here called Essence of the Heart Sutra, which is the Dalai Lama's commentary on it. And on our website, I put a link to Amazon if you like that sort of thing, so that you can download it and read it. So the Dalai Lama says that this meditative absorption, this state of mind, this meditative state that the Buddha got into that sort of initiated all this teaching, although it's not a teaching by the Buddha, it's a teaching from Avalokiteshvara, which is interesting. We'll get to that too. Is the meditative absorption on the varieties of phenomena called the appearance of the profound. And His Holiness says the appearance of the profound is, the profound is emptiness. And the appearance of the profound, the meditation on the appearance of the profound, is a meditative mind where you directly see the nature of reality, which is that it's empty of your own fantasy projections into reality. So the idea, the Buddhist idea here, is that basically, day in and day out, we are always walking around and we have a lot of ideas about what's going on around us, which is necessary in order to function in this world. We have ideas about what's attractive and unattractive, what's square and what's round, what's warm and what's cold, and ideas about everything. And we have cognitions about things and we understand things. Things have meaning. But all that stuff comes from our own mind. All of that stuff is our own cognition. I mean, for those of you who've been mothers, you know that when those little critters pop out, they don't cognize much. They're just sort of there. And you know they're not thinking about much of anything, but they're aware of a lot. And they get more and more aware of more and more as time goes on. But there's no verbalization going on in their awareness initially. They're just noticing stuff, like you in particular, you know, especially when they're hungry, I imagine, you know, never having been a father, but it seems like we know these things. So they're not cognizing in the way in which we are. Now, it's not that they're not cognizing from the Buddhist point of view, but we can understand the difference between the way we relate to the world and the way they relate to the world. And that's kind of a metaphor, kind of a way of understanding, getting at something about what this meditative mind was that the Buddha moved into. Because the way the teaching goes is he was able to see things without thinking about what he was seeing, if he didn't want to. But that was a matter of choice. That he could look at a person and he could notice that they were male and female but not think about the fact that they were male and female, or young and old, or attractive and not attractive. He could just see something. Now, probably what he could see is not something that we would want to see unless we were made of stern stuff, because often what he saw was a bag of bones that had a certain degree of cognition, certain degree of awareness that was associated with it. And what I mean by this is that when we look at people, we see clothes, and maybe we see skin, and we imagine there's a person there. I've often thought that when physicians look at people, they must be able to go back and forth in what they see. And sometimes they see musculature, and they see kind of internal conditions of health or lack of health. But they see beyond just the skin, if they choose to, or don't see beyond the skin, if they choose to. So the Buddha could see what was actually there, which is that we are transitory, that we are animals, that we're always changing, that we have in our minds, and I think he could see this, that we have in our minds that we're not changing, that we have in our minds this conviction that we're the same from moment to moment and day to day and year to year and month to month and so on and so forth, that we believe this, and that he could see that. But of course, none of that stuff is true. He could see all the appearances, but he could also see deeper into what was happening. And that's what made him a Buddha, was that he could do both at the same time. That he could see what we see, and he could see reality in the same moment of cognition, as they say. For us, it's very difficult to step away from the ordinary way of seeing and thinking about things, even for small moments. The notion that we could do both at the same time and in some fundamental way.
It's the pipes here.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I was worried that it was the water heater or something like that back there. So, for us to just for a few moments to be able to get into a state of mind where our ideas and our representations are just a little bit softened, you know, and so we're not totally controlled by them is a rare and difficult phenomenon. Now, you might want to ask, well, why bother to do this? You know, I mean, what is the point of doing this? And the Buddhist answer, the traditional Buddhist answer would be something like, well, you're going to find some freedom if you could do something like this. It's called liberation, finding liberation, or enlightenment. And that all sounds pretty grandiose, you know, and difficult and way out there in the future and so on and so forth. And I think that that's probably true. But on the other hand, it also seems to me that if you could step into just a little bit of that state of mind where you're not completely controlled by the thoughts in your mind, that you might get a little peace. And that in itself on a daily basis would be really completely wonderful. Liberation would be nice, enlightenment would be nicer, but peace of mind between when I sit down in the morning, when I get up, and when I get up from my meditation cushion and make breakfast, to me, on a daily basis, is not only adequate, it's utterly necessary. And that if I don't get that little quality of peacefulness, that little hit of peacefulness once a day in the morning, my day just goes to hell in a handbasket immediately and quickly, very quickly indeed. And it'd be nice, you know, if I could end the day by doing that and maybe in the middle of the day do something like that. But as the day goes on, my mind gets all churned up, and then I can't. And it's just kind of impossible. So if I sit in the evening and try and meditate, it's kind of like I get to watch the dramatic unfoldment of the greatest story ever told, as somebody once said, which is me, 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 always me, me. They did to me, I did to them, the other did to, and how did that affect me, and Wall Street is doing to me, and it's a me, 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 me. It's like, please stop, you know. And it's really hard, and it doesn't. But in the morning, anyway, I can get some quiet, and I can put me in some sort of perspective, because unless I've had some really weird dreams, I'm not just totally, well, who can I blame anyway? It's just me doing something to me if I've had weird dreams. So, okay, it's a little bit easier. So, I think for us, that maybe that's what a lot of meditation is about, and the value of meditation. Now, the other kinds of things that are in the Heart Sutra could be thought of as being philosophy, and they're often thought of as being philosophy when the sutra is being taught. Or, there's another way to think about it, which is that they're not philosophy, but they're the record of somebody's experience who had a deeper ability to get into a meditative state than we have. And therefore, it represents a kind of guidance. There's a lot of stuff in the sutra that sounds really strange, like no eyes. Avalokiteshvara says, well, the truth is you don't have any eyes. It sounds like he's saying you don't have any eyes. That sounds weird, because obviously we have eyes. Don't have any ears. Well, that probably doesn't make any sense, because, you know, the conversation is going on here between Avalokiteshvara and Shariputra, who are both students of the Buddha. Obviously, if Avalokiteshvara is saying to Shariputra there are no ears, that would be a weird statement, because then how would Shariputra hear it if he didn't have any ears? So obviously this means something else, and it means something about a deeper level of experience. So as the weeks go by, as we meet here, what I'm going to try and do is decode this for you so that it starts making some degree of sense in the context of this statement that the Buddha entered the meditative absorption on the varieties of phenomena called the appearance of the profound, because the whole sutra is about the appearance of the profound in the context of meditating. So it represents guidance for us. It represents a place to go. And why do this? Well, if you've gotten a job in Le Grand and you're from Massachusetts and you fly to Tri-Cities and get off the airplane and you drive here and you rent an apartment and you decide you want to go to Boise for some reason, and you've never been to Boise, you would have a map. You would have a map, because how would you find Boise without a map? I mean, you might wander around in circles until you got on the highway and saw a sign that said Boise this way. That wouldn't be very efficient. It would be much more efficient if you had a map and you could identify where your apartment was and how did you get to the freeway, and then which direction you wanted to go when you got on the highway, so you went to Boise instead of Portland. And then you get to Boise, and maybe you could have a nice Thai dinner or something, or buy the furniture that you need for your apartment, whatever you wanted to do. But with the map, you could get to Boise. Without the map, you might get to Boise eventually, but you might get to Boise by way of Spokane, which would be extremely inconvenient and time-consuming and probably expensive and a pain in the neck. So the map is really valuable in that respect, because it shows you the destination. So what I want to do is decode the destination, even though it may seem an unusual destination, and not make cognitive sense. And it won't make cognitive sense exactly, although it's somewhat comprehensible. It won't make total sense. And why is that? Because it's that place which is beneath cognition, beneath thinking, outside of thinking. It's that place where our minds are leaving us alone. So not only do we have some peace of mind, but we can see what's really going on because we experience it directly. So you may not want to experience it directly. You may not care. But I'm sure you'd like to have some peace of mind. And so that goal is what's described. And it's valuable, because if you don't know what to aim for, you won't get there. You just go around in circles. Right? And that's why there are all these Buddhist teachings someone said, you know, the Buddha talked about reality and realities beyond thought and beyond mind. And how many words did he speak about all of this? Why did he say anything? Well, the reason he said something was, if you share something, an approximation from his mind to our mind, that will be a useful map. And of course, then when you get there, the map is irrelevant. You don't need the map once you're in Boise. I don't need a map to get to Boise anymore. I get on the highway, I know which way Boise is, I just go there. And I know how to get to the highway from my house. I only needed the map once. And once I got to Boise, I didn't need the map anymore. Okay? But I would have never gotten there without the map. So we'll be talking about the map for a while. Okay, so that's what I have to say about this. And if you have any questions about this or something we want to talk about, you have some time to do that, and that would be useful. And if not, we have some tea and some cookies and stuff like that. So,
Dave,
what's your pleasure?
Could you read the Heart Sutra to us?
The whole thing?
Yeah, just so we have some ideas to where.
Okie dokie.
Thank you very much.
Sure, of course.
And we'll be chanting the Zen Buddhist version just before we meditate as a way of settling down. It's very quick. It's like a one-page or half-page.
It's even shorter than this because this one begins with, thus I have heard at one time. Yeah. Thus have I once heard, the Blessed One was staying at Rajgir at Vulture Peak, along with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. And at that time, the Blessed One entered the meditative absorption on the varieties of phenomena called the appearance of the profound. At the time as well, the Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, clearly beheld the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom itself, and saw that even the five aggregates are empty of intrinsic existence. Thereupon, through the Buddha's inspiration, the Venerable Shariputra spoke to the Noble Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, and said, how should any noble son or noble daughter who wished to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom training? And there is, in this translation, there's like a missing comma. How should any noble son or noble daughter who wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom training. That's how do you engage in the practice? How do you engage in the training? So there's a problem in the syntax here. When this had been said, the Holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the great being, spoke to the Venerable Shariputra and said, Shariputra, any noble son or noble daughter who so wishes to engage in the practice of the profound perfection of wisdom should clearly see this way. They should see perfectly that even the five aggregates are empty of intrinsic existence. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form, too, is not other than emptiness. Likewise, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness are all empty. Therefore, Shariputra, all phenomena are emptiness. They are without defining characteristics. They are not born. They do not cease. They are not defiled. They are not undefiled. They are not deficient, and they are not complete. Therefore, Shariputra, in emptiness there is no form, no feelings, no perceptions, no mental formations, and no consciousness. There is no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, and no mind. There is no form, no sound, no smell, no taste, no texture, and no mental objects. There is no eye element, and so on up to no mind element, including up to no element of mental consciousness. There is no ignorance, there is no extinction of ignorance, and so on up to no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Likewise, there is no suffering, origin, cessation, or path. There is no wisdom, no attainment, and even no non-attainment. Therefore, Shariputra, since bodhisattvas have no attainments, they rely on perfection of wisdom and abide in it. Having no obscuration in their minds, they have no fear. And by going utterly beyond error, they will reach the end of nirvana. That's peace. All the Buddhas, too, who abide in the three times, attain the full awakening of unexcelled perfect enlightenment by relying on this profound perfection of wisdom. Therefore, one should know that the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unexcelled mantra, the mantra equal to the unexcelled, the mantra that quells all suffering, is true because it is not deceptive. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is proclaimed tadyata gate gate para gate para samgate bodhi svaha. Shariputra, the bodhisattva, the great being, should train in the perfection of wisdom in this way. Thereupon, the Blessed One arose from that meditative absorption and commended the holy Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva, the great being, saying, "This is excellent. Excellent, excellent, O noble child, it is just so. It should be just so. One must practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you have revealed. For then even the Tathagatas will rejoice." Tathagatas are the Duskons, another word for the Buddhas. As the Blessed One uttered these words, the Venerable Shariputra, the Holy Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, the Great Being, along with the entire assembly, including the worlds of gods, humans, asuras, and Gandharvas, all rejoiced and hailed what the Blessed One had said. So, by the time I finish decoding this, you'll understand all this stuff that doesn't make any sense and understand how it is that even though you don't have an ear, you have an ear. And even though you don't have a mind, you have a mind. And how you can find some peace of mind for the mind that you have but don't have. It actually all does make sense eventually. So, okay? Oops. More?
I have something to say.
Yes.
So I was talking about this group with a friend of mine, and I was kind of talking about what I think I know about Buddhism. And what I think I heard myself say was, Dharma talks and the gatherings that I've experienced with this group is such that it's a lot of different ways to explain how to empty your mind, how to think about nothing. But it really comes down to just nothing. But there's all these different ways to say it. I mean, if you were a direct person, you might just say, this is what you need to do to meditate. Because it's really quite
simple,
limited and simple in what you're supposed to do. But all the different people that do what they do, there's all these different ways to explain how to empty and be silent and be nothing.
Well, and be something that's nothing.
And be what?
Something that's
at
nothing.
At the same time.
Nothing.
Yeah.
See, the tricky thing is reality is actually paradoxical. Mm-hmm. Because our minds, well, reality is just what it is. Mm-hmm. But our minds are wired, if you will. Our minds like to draw distinctions between this and that. They're dualistic. Everything that we think about is this versus that, this versus the other thing. But reality is just what it is. So it's not the one side and not the other side of the duality. It's both sides of the duality. Does that make sense? Reality is both sides of the duality our minds create. Like, we can say that a certain person is a good person, or we can say a certain person is a bad person. But the reality is everybody has elements that we would refer to as good and has elements that we would refer to as bad. Nobody is just good or just bad. Everybody is a combination of the things we call good and bad. So if we stop calling people either good or bad, then what we recognize is that they are both good and bad. And then if we really pay attention, we recognize that good and bad has nothing to do with them. It's our own mind interpreting, you know, what's going on with that person. So if you get to the place where you say, well, that's just the person and it's my own mind that's thinking they're good or they're bad, and then you notice the characteristics in the person, some of which are good and some of which are bad, that you call good or bad. They do have those characteristics. They're just not good or bad. Then the reality of what a person is paradoxical, because they contain these oppositions. And all of reality contains oppositions in the way, because of the way we think about things. So as long as we think about reality, if the closest we can get to it with thinking is when we get to thinking things paradoxically. Paradoxically means incorporating the extremes, the opposites. It's sort of like, it's paradoxical that somebody can be both good and bad.
Or nothing and something.
Or nothing and something.
Which we all are.
Which we all are. So to say that a person, you can say that you empty your mind out, but to say that a person is empty or that your mind is empty doesn't mean it's gone or non-existent. Mm-hmm. It's there, and the person is there. And that's really important, because meditation is not about obliterating ourselves. Meditation is about getting to the reality of what we are, which is paradoxical in that it both is some things and is not other things. Does that make sense, the paradox? So you know you're into reality when it doesn't make any sense because it's paradoxical.
And you have to be careful about the whole emptiness concept, because that's where a lot of the fear comes in meditation, especially silent meditation. A lot of you guys have been doing guided meditation and Green Tara and so forth. Now if we enter into silent meditation, what starts to come in up is this fear of dissolution, of emptiness, of voidness, of what will happen to us if we are who we are, you know, in our own minds, our little boxes that we've created. So that's something that's really important to think about, I think, Paul, since we're going to be exploring the silent meditation for a change. It's very different that way, and you really have to kind of come to terms with your own mind about what that emptiness means and not get afraid, become afraid of it, that it's annihilation or nihilistic.
Even if it's just a glimpse, it's like, oh.
Give me a break. Yeah. Give me a break from me. It would be really nice. Yeah. Do you have a question, Kathy?
Just language to talk. So the emptying of the mind, is it possible that another word that could be used for that is the centeredness that one gets? Is that?
Yeah.
From the Quaker tradition, so we center. Silent meditation, but I'm not sure.
Well, I'm going to guess that it's the same. You know, I mean, the only way I would know that it was the same was if I went to a Quaker meeting house and hung out with you guys and we shared our experiences together when that was happening for you and some semblance of that was happening for me. But I think it's the same, and the reason I say I think it's the same is my own experience of getting into that quietness and that kind of empty space where my mind leaves me alone, more or less, for short periods of time. When that happens, it seems like my mind is flying all over the place. And when that happens, it seems like as my mind gets quiet, I come into a center, which is me. And then, paradoxically, it's kind of like you go down into yourself. It's like going down a funnel, and then you come out the other side, and the funnel opens up into everything. And my experience is that the center becomes everywhere. It becomes this vast space around me that I'm part of. And I am the center, but I'm not the center at that point. So I don't know if that relates to the Quaker experience or not.
Thank you.
It does.
It does.
Okay. By trade, I'm a professor of world religions, and I've, over the years, come to really believe deeply that all these different religions and spiritualities that we're aware of as modern people, because, you know, a few hundred years ago, people only knew their own, right? So now, in the last couple hundred years, we've learned about all these different religions, and are they talking about the same thing or not? And I think a lot of the time, they are, But the language is different. We get lost in the language and we get confused by the language that's used, you know, to talk about similar experiences. So I kind of take it on faith that since we all have the same kind of brains and, you know, two arms and two legs, and it's true some of us are women and some of us are men, but essentially the essence of what we are, same everywhere. So wouldn't it be the case that if people are having some kind of deep experience of peace or something that they identify as something spiritual, doesn't it make sense that they're probably having something similar going on? Anyhow, it does to me. I guess I take it as an article of faith. A lot of people would disagree, but that just seems right to me. So I'm glad that was helpful.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm curious, in the Quaker tradition, do they, when they're centering, is there a technique, or do you use the breath, or is it just quiet?
Different people have different ways. Some people will say something, just kind of meditate, mm-hmm. just kind of breathe. Pretty soon, I'm gone. Mm-hmm. Nice. That's the visit. Mm-hmm. I call it the divine, but that's mm-hmm. what I call it. It's a wonderful place to be. And I guess when you're enlightened, you walk around like that all the time.
Sounds good to me. I don't know.
I don't know.
Not being enlightened, and all the people I've met who I might have thought were enlightened are... They don't talk about it. Me enlightened? Me a Buddha? Come on. You know, it's like the Dalai Lama always says, I'm just a simple monk. What do I know? It's kind of like, well, that's true. Okay. You are just a simple monk, and that level of simplicity is phenomenal. I'll go for some. If I could. So what do you think? Shall we more? It's 6:45.
Oh, yeah, no, let's keep going until 7.
Well, I don't have anything.
You have something to say.
No. I'm not very good at dialogicness, am I? Mm-hmm. I'm much more the old fashioned kind of teacher of you just sort of sit there and talk. Doesn't Loy have any questions?
I have one.
Ah.
So the Heart Sutra is the heart.
No, the heart's... Well, let's go ahead.
Or is it the heart of the sutra?
Go ahead and ask me what you're going to ask.
So if there's a heart, is there like a third eye? Is there a... You know how we all have the
yes.
different organs or eyes? Or is it just the heart of a sutra?
I think that they're all of the meanings... makes sense.
Oh.
So that the Heart Sutra is the heart of wisdom, the essence of wisdom, because the heart is the essence. And I think that the essence of wisdom is in the heart. So when you see with the eye of the heart, when you see with the eye of the heart is when you're seeing, really seeing wisdom,
exactly.
Right? When you see with your brain, you're seeing something that's interesting. But when you're experiencing what they call wisdom, which is the direct view of emptiness, although they do talk about the third eye, you're located in your heart. And what that third eye is something else we could talk about. But the locus of your sense of I, my experience, let me be specific here, my experience is... that the locus of the sense of I, when I'm in the space of having some cognition of emptiness, is not in my head. Mm-hmm. The locus of I mm-hmm. is in the center of my chest.
Okay.
So in that sense, the Heart Sutra is both the essence of the teaching, but it's also a teaching from the heart. But it's also the Heart Sutra in the sense that the teaching comes from Avalokiteshvara, who is... usually understood as the Buddha or the being that's 100% compassion and love. That there is nothing, there is not one iota, one piece of a fingernail that is not loving and compassionate toward everybody around. So when Avalokiteshvara is teaching this, He's teaching this as an expression of love and compassion. So it comes from that heart as well. So probably no matter how you want to think about the meaning of the term heart in Heart Sutra, and you ask the question, is that the way in which it's the Heart Sutra? The answer is probably going to be yes. Probably the only way in which it would not be yes would be if you took the heart out of somebody and replaced it with somebody else's heart. I mean, we do that sort of thing right now. Would that not be the source of something? I don't know. That doesn't make any sense. Forget I was going there. I can't think of any way in which it's not the heart. I can't think of any way in which it's not the heart. Because it's the essence. The essence is both wisdom and compassion. That when you really see what's true, you really see your deep relationship and connections with everybody.
So when we say we're listening to someone with our heart, that's getting out of, it's getting out of all that cognition. Good, bad, and all that cognition junk and trying, and you know, attempting to see
compassion.
It as it is, with compassion.
Right.
This would be something you understand, I think, from doing hospice work, that I was talking with a psychologist friend of mine, and he said that the essence of the way he does psychotherapy is to just be there with somebody and see them and be with them totally. And it's not like he tries to do some sort of technique. That if there's a technique, it's being deeply and fully present with another person, and that has a natural healing quality. And when he's there, everybody is also in their heartfelt relationship with each other. And that's when people are dying, that's the best we can do for them.
It's the only way to be.
It's the only way to be. There you go.
Yeah, it really
right?
is the
yeah.
only way.
The
that's
only way.
Actually taken on a new tone in this culture when you can do that with someone because of all the distractions folks have with social media or, you know, phones or whatever. If you can do what you've just described, regardless of hospice or not, I mean, because we're all so spider-webbed if you're not right there.
Yeah. Some people have taken up as a practice, you know, turning off their cell phones when they get together or when they're in a restaurant or something like that, so that they're actually present with what's going on not being distracted. And I mean, my cell phone usually, if I'm traveling, is in my car, not in my pocket. And you know, I have to play telephone tag with people because, you know, I don't want to be wandering around. I'm at the end of this communications bubble. Not that I don't want to be in touch with people, but when I'm out in doing things, I want to be there doing things, and I don't want somebody kind of yanking me out of that. And the other thing, which is even worse, is that I, like everybody else that I know, especially as techie, as an information addict. So if I have the cell phone in hand, I'll look at it.
Yeah.
You know, what time is it? What's the weather? Hey, what's the news? Anybody send me an email? Like, okay, does that really matter? I don't leave it in the car and check it at 6 o'clock. It does irritate some people. We have a really good friend. Why didn't you answer your phone when I called you? Well, that was because I didn't have one. What do you mean you didn't have one? For years we didn't have a cell phone, and it bugged her. What do you mean? You don't have a cell phone? What's wrong with you? Well, you know, I mean, she lives in a world where she's always stuck in traffic. And so she makes good use of being stuck in traffic by talking on her phone. But that's not the world I live in. I'm never stuck in, well, Le Grand traffic jam, right? You know, five cars going by. Well, maybe, but you know, they're very good with the train whistles. You know when they're moving, and you know when you want to go to Island Avenue instead of trying to get across Pine Street. Unless you're not paying attention, if you don't hear the whistles, you're probably okay. But if you hear them, go down Island. You know, so I pay attention to that. All right. So, yeah, five cars is a Le Grand traffic jam. You know that, all right? But you know, she lives in the Bay Area, and she gets caught in horrible traffic. It's a good use of her time. And so she wants to talk with me, and that's great. I love talking with her, but I don't want to have my cell phone in my pocket. I really don't.
Maybe it's good use of your time. You can also do mindfulness practice when you're in the car.
That's true. I mean, I do.
Teachers like Steve Stuckey.
Yeah.
Zen Abbott, who taught that a lot about mindfulness.
Yeah. In the class.
Absolutely. Just watching your mind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Depends where you're stuck in traffic.
Yeah. Exactly.
Is there a place where you could be stuck in traffic that you can't do? You mean like Los
405, perhaps?
Yeah. I mean, when oh, that, but that's not stuck in traffic. That's everybody's going by at 90 miles an hour.
Yeah, but suddenly you're going 2 miles an hour, but you've got to be alert because in the next 10 seconds, it clicks up to 80 miles an hour, and there's no slowing.
But that's being mindful.
It does.
It makes you present in the
moment. There is that mindfulness.
So it is mindful in that way.
There is that mindfulness.
But it's very focused.
Yeah, but see, there's a difference between mindfulness and being spaced out.
Mm-hmm. Mindfulness and what?
Being spaced out.
Yeah, mindfulness.
So mindfulness is noticing all the stuff that's going on. And just right here and right now, what's actually going on. Mm-hmm. And what's actually going on is I'm going 2 miles an hour. But suddenly, the car in front of me is not going 2 miles an hour anymore. And so I need to be going as fast as the car in front of me. That's being mindful.
I'm not talking about that kind of mindfulness. I'm talking about that when you just let go of the stimulation and just be and not let the dualities get going. And
that's meditation.
Your thoughts.
Hey, you probably better not.
No, I'm not talking about meditation. I'm just talking about being in the...
Yeah, but that's a kind of meditation versus a kind of mindfulness, I think, that you're talking about, where you just sort of relax into now and don't let yourself get distracted by anything. That's what you're talking about. But that's not... I don't think that that's so much mindfulness. That's a kind of meditation of a kind of a flow of sort of an internal breath experience without paying attention to lots of stuff that's going on. Kind of more one-pointed and peaceful. That's why I call it meditation.
Yeah, being present totally, the mindfulness practice has to do with like kind of cracking open the moment. So actually, so that other senses can take place. So they would actually, if you were very mindful in the car, you'd be a lot more, you'd allow those other senses to kick in to perhaps save you from tail-ending the car. In front of you,
because
you'd be so totally
exactly
in the moment.
Yeah. Many times I'm driving and I think, oh boy, I better remember that I'm driving. You know, be mindful of what I'm doing.
there's an article I have my students reading my Buddhism class at the university, and I can't remember the name of it right now, but it was published in the San Francisco Chronicle about 10 or 15 years ago now, I guess. So what this is about is that there used to be something called, there is something called the Central Freeway, and it's in the center of San Francisco. And the Central Freeway opened into the city. So if you wanted to get to a certain part of the city, you took the freeway, and then that took you up toward Golden Gate Park. And originally, it wasn't supposed to end there. And it was back in the days when they were going to build freeways all over the place, and the citizens of San Francisco said enough. And so the freeway just sort of stopped at these two streets. After the earthquake of 1987, was that it, the Loma Prieta earthquake? 91. Was it 91? Or whatever it was. Anyhow, they had to close that part of the freeway because it was unstable. And they finally decided... Excuse me, they knew that it was unstable and they decided they had to tear it down. And that meant all the traffic was going to be changed that was coming into San Francisco. And the consequence of that, they expected, was the world's biggest traffic jam because it was going to sort of cascade through the entire Bay Area. And when they expected that the day they closed the Central Freeway to start tearing it down, there was going to be a traffic jam that was going to extend halfway to Sacramento or something unbelievable like that. And they were writing about this in the paper and scaring the bejesus out of everybody. So then the day came, and they closed the Central Freeway, and there were no traffic jams. So this guy wrote this article about what he thought had happened. And he said he was out on the roads because he was a reporter for the Chronicle, and they were going to report on what's happening. He just happened to be a Zen student also. And he was looking at what was going on, and what he noticed was everybody got very mindfully attentive to what was happening and creative about finding new ways to get to where they needed to go. And because they were paying a whole lot of attention to what everybody else was doing and were not being obnoxious and cutting each other off and actually being courteous and finding new ways to get to places, there were no traffic jams anywhere. There were fewer traffic jams than on a typical day when the Central Freeway was open. And so he reported on this. And then after a week, it was back to normal, and there were traffic jams everywhere. You know, but for that little bit of time, right? And so this is a true story. This happened. So that's the kind of mindfulness that Kay is talking about, when you crack open things to more of your senses and pay more attention to things that are going on all around you. People weren't spaced out. There are other weird things, like women in bikinis who are handing out bagels in the street corner, and it was all San Francisco stuff that was going on. He reported also, but California Hard Bodies is what they were called. It's a great article. It's really a great article. It's fun. Anyway, okay. That's a good place to stop.